We're here to talk about science and politics and the intersection between science and politics. And there are a whole series of different ways that science and politics intersect. And I hope that we can explore at least some of them. One way I am a living representative of, which is that politicians fund science. I work at the National Institutes of Health, and we get about $28, $29 billion per year from the Congress to do biomedical research. So that's one way that science and politics intersect, funding. Science and politics intersect in ways also of prohibition. Sometimes politics eliminates or prevents doing certain kinds of research, and we've seen some of that in the case of cloning, for example, although not in the United States. We've seen that in the case of artificial reproductive technologies and in the case of stem cells. A final way, although not, this is not a comprehensive list, that science and politics intersect relate to the use of scientific data to make policy decisions, to make all sorts of other major decisions. And so these are a whole variety of ways science and politics intersect. As you all know, it's no secret that there's been a lot of unrest in the scientific community about the political situation today and what some people have called the politicization of scientific of science and the use of science. And so what we've done is to bring together a panel of enormously talented and experienced people to talk about these various facets of politics and science. So what we're going to run is like probably every other session you've been to. We're going to have comments to begin with from the panelists, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience, and the hope is that we can have a lively exchange here on this very important topic. So I'm going to introduce the panelists and then ask them to speak. So immediately to my left here is Lawrence Krauss, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at Case Western University and has written, I think it's seven popular books, including one that I haven't read, but I know that my daughter's boyfriend has read, The Physics of Star Trek, because he's always quoting it to me when I sort of poo-poo science fiction and the uses of science fiction. And he's actually an aspiring physicist, and actually Lawrence Krauss is one of his heroes. Next to him is Nigel Cameron, who's president of the Institute for Biotechnology and the Human Future, as well as the director of the Center on Nanotechnology and Society, both at the Chicago Kent College of Law, which is one of the most heavily involved law schools in the area of biology and health law. Next to him is Dorothy Zinberg. She's a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she works within the Kennedy School of Government for the Belfer Center of Science and International Affairs, and has advised numerous very prestigious organizations like the National Academy of Science on science policy. And last but certainly not least is Neil Lane, who served for 3 years between 1998 and 2001 as the science advisor to President Clinton. Before that, he was the director of the National Science Foundation. He's currently a professor at Rice University in Houston. And fortunately for you, I've left out all the other important governmental roles and jobs he's filled. Otherwise, we would never have a question. So I will begin at that end with Professor Lane, and we'll work our way this way to talk about the relationship between science and politics, how it is working, how it should work, and some suggestions.
Thank you very much, Ezekiel. I very much appreciate being here. After the introductions of the nature of this panel, I'm wondering why I'm here. But since I am, and since I learned in Washington a long time ago that not having anything really deep or substantive to say does not prevent anybody from talking, I will take a minute. I also had the great benefit to work with your brother, Rahm, a little bit in the White House. We overlapped a little bit. I learned a great deal from him.
I'll ask you about how you benefited.
We'll talk. We'll talk. So here, what you're going to hear from me is just from my own perspective. So some time in academics, physicist, research physicist, for a long time, in a university, getting a little bit involved in policy and government making, then the job at NSF, and then the White House. So it gives me a window, but there are lots of different windows, and we're going to hear from many of those windows today. Maybe the easiest thing for me to make some points is to start by making some assertions. So these are things I believe are true. Some of them I think are obviously true, and I think we would all agree with them, and others are certainly debatable. So first, science and technology affects every aspect of all our lives. In fact, the lives of most people, certainly in the developed world and increasingly the developing world. And because of that, public policy depends in almost every area, depends on science and technology. So whether it's energy or it's health or it's environmental protection, national domestic security, all these issues, all depends on science and technology. For that reason, the public knows that. General public knows that in this country. So they expect at least a couple of things out of the federal government. They expect that the government will ensure, through whatever means it has available to us, that the U.S. will have the best science, will make the important discoveries, will have here in our own communities the best scientists in the world. And we have done pretty well as a nation over a long period of time, but by no means are we preeminent in all important fields of science today, nor should we necessarily be. But the public expects that. I also think the public expects the government to see that science and technology are applied to benefit people. There are a lot of different ways to do that, but the public expects that. This has also worked very well, I think, since the end of World War II, which is kind of the line where I start talking about modern involvement of government and science. Second point I want to make, or assertion, is much has changed in 60 years in every single dimension. Science is very different. What we know and what we're able to do scientifically in research really pushes the envelope, and that's what raises a lot of the ethical issues and other issues we're going to talk about. Second, institutions have changed. Universities are very different, even in my young life. They are much more business enterprises. They much more are interested in intellectual property. They have partnerships with the private sector in ways they never did before and that weren't anticipated by this man, Vannevar Bush, whom many credit for getting our system of science and government partnership in place. Third point, national labs have changed. They're changing. They're transforming. Many of them don't know what their missions are. It's unclear to them and unclear to us and the agencies that fund them what their missions are, and I'm worried about that. Fourth, industry is a major player in research and development, mainly very applied research in product development, but they fund twice as much R&D as the federal government. So that's very different from what it was 60 years ago. Fifth, other nations, as I've already alluded to, are advancing, and they're advancing very rapidly. They've overtaken us in certain areas. They're certainly catching up in others. And finally, the federal government's application of science to benefit the public is in question. It has been questioned by many of us and by others, and that's something we'll talk about. My third assertion is that in recent years, it follows from what I just said, for a whole variety of reasons, politics has too often trumped, if you like, science and evidence. A lot of reasons for that, and we'll have a chance to talk about that. So let me conclude my comments anyway. First, the federal government, I believe, has critical roles. Support basic research, because industry is not going to do it, and it's critically important. Two, ensure that the science and technology, no matter who discovers it, is used to benefit people in this country and increasingly in the world. Three, be open with Americans about what the science actually is. What do scientists believe? What are the facts? And now, how do we as government, how do I as the government, set policy based on what I know about the science? Policy depends on other things, but I just need to be clear with the public what role science has. Second part of my conclusion is we as a society have an education and communication problem about science and its relationship to policy. Scientists have to help out in this. So K-12, I won't talk about. There's a lot of expertise in the room and at the conference. Excellent talks on K-12. Big challenge. Public understanding. The public doesn't know anything about science to speak of, and therefore you can't blame people for sometimes taking the positions they take. Third is the government's accountability. We all have to demand the government be accountable for what it's doing. So I would say to the general public, all of us as citizens, ask hard questions, demand answers, and if you don't like what you get, don't elect the people again. To scientists, get involved. Get involved in policy. Get involved in politics in whatever way you're inclined to do, because the problem is shared by all of us, and I think we as scientists have a special responsibility because of our experience and our knowledge base. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dorothy?
Thank you very much. Each of us wants to take home something from meetings like this, and one of the things I'd like to take home is my colleague's modesty, because I have worked with him, I think, on issues every place but Rice University, and I want to learn just a little of his carefulness in expressing how great his contributions have been to science.
A lot to be modest about.
And he talked on, Neil talked on many of the subjects I had planned to talk about. In fact, I would say I have scrunched into the short talk a whole semester's work on science and society. So I thought I'd go over some of the issues I see now, give you what I see is what's happening and how we might have gotten there. My concern is about a growing rejection of evidence in favor of a moral agenda in the government of this country. And there are other people here who can talk to this more specifically, but I would like to throw this out as what the underlying premise is of much of our concerns. I don't want to argue that scientists are pure, that they're purer than any other part of the society. It was very clear that at one time, particularly after World War II, which you used as the year that things began to change, people like Bruno Brunovsky were saying, look, we are a bounded community of scientists. You give us the money, our values, our behavior are such that we can police ourselves without any intervention from the outside. That has been a big change. With that change has come real problems, because scientists themselves have become lobbyists, and they're just as rough as other lobbyists. Universities and scientists in a number of instances are involved in unholy alliances with industry. Some of them have been documented, some of them haven't. So I'm not talking about the purity of science and scientists. I'm just saying that I think we have larger issues overriding this. Because there's no doubt but that science won World War II. I mean, if you look at radar, lasers, penicillin, observations about mental health, the first major funding in looking at mental health as a national problem came out of the high percentage of people who were discharged with so-called neurotic problems, and the government came full force into supporting major changes in the way we thought about mental health in this country. I thought I'd use just as a lens through which to look at some of these changes the role of the science advisor, and to use what people in Aspen will appreciate is the value of real estate and place. If in 1959, Eisenhower took on the first science advisor, who was a man by the name of George Kistiakowsky, who had worked on triggering the nuclear bombs, he took on Jerry Wiesner, a well-known Democrat, to be on the advisory committee. When Kennedy was elected, they simply shifted places. And Wiesner, who then went on to become later the president of MIT, became the science advisor, and Kistiakowsky worked for him. There was a general level of lack of political involvement in this, the sense of science is greater and our political interests are really much smaller. If you cut to today, I mean, my favorite picture from that era is of Jerry Wiesner puffing on a pipe. I'm sure he wouldn't be doing it today. But lounging against President Kennedy's desk. And what was very clear, his office was just a few doors down the hall, and whenever he felt like it, he would drop in and talk to the president. And it didn't mean that the president always accepted his advice. In fact, in one famous one about space, he said, Jerry, I'm sure the science is right, but I'm making a political decision, period. Today, not only does the science advisor not wander into the president's office, he doesn't even have the same title. Traditionally, the science advisor is also called the assistant to the president, That title is gone. And for the real estate part of it, his office no longer exists in the White House or any place near it. He's out there, and his job is to support what the president said. So we've seen this really, there have been bumps in between. Nixon fired a science advisor. Ford brought on someone again. But what we've seen is this tremendous politicization. I think it's come about in just some of the ways that Neil has mentioned, but let me add a few others. Scientists themselves became very political, beginning with Goldwater, when scientists and engineers signed on saying that he was not fit to be president. That was the beginning of saying we are above science. I'm not saying we're above politics. They were really deeply into it. So that you've had that part of every presidential election of scientists having a political stake. I think when I was first beginning as a scientist, it was very clear what was science and what was engineering, or what was basic science and what was applied science. And that was easy then to separate so that you could make, we're going to fund this research because it's basic science, and that's beyond politics. Once you get into fungible boundaries, then you're into a whole new era, which is where we are now. And so that you can't separate these things very clearly. And you can't separate, and as Neil mentioned about new technologies, new problems, we're into much more profound issues about what is a human being, what is spirituality, what is the essence of life, that science is now looking at. When you were only looking at space, that didn't affect anybody's conception of what it was to be a human being, what the moral boundaries were of this. And that's where we are now, so that it is much tougher to deal with these issues. But at the same time, having said that, I am appalled at what's going on at Washington and the time I'm spending there, what's going on. For example, Doug Melton is a great molecular biologist at Harvard who has obtained funding from private resources to do stem cell research. Unlike a lot of scientists, he is not overpromising that they will cure diabetes immediately, but the sense is that this work is very important to curing a disease. This is on the hit list of the federal government. You cannot do stem cell research on any government funding. They have brought this down to a point that if one of Doug's students wants to use a refrigerator that might have any public government funding in its original purchase price, the university has to buy Professor Melton another refrigerator. They cannot use a test tube. They cannot have joint conferences. That everything that makes science strong is being destroyed by a vindictive government that is pursuing its anti-abortion agenda, which is underlying, I believe, much of the funding decisions. So that Professor Melton has to go to the great expense of duplicating all of the ordinary reagents, equipment that are used in universities today, because the government says, we once put money into that through NIH, through the National Science Foundation. You can't. Very concerning for a lot of us. So we've got, let me just finish, because I could go on for a whole course, of the whole business of where we have to make an effort to separate science and religion and science and politics as much as we can. When von Eschenbach was, he was sworn in as the head of
the NCI.
Yes. One of his slides said, "We live in a country blessed by God." This would have been unheard of 20 years ago. Everybody was in shock, but this is pervasive now. I have not been able to pin it down, but I have been told on fairly good basis that there is one very distinguished scientist who begins the day with prayer meetings at the National Cancer Institute. We could talk later. Okay, maybe you've got the data. So, okay, let me end that, but with one other thing. About, again, Neil talking about the role of the scientists in explaining science to society. I feel that part of the problems in science have been that the scientists don't listen carefully enough to the public, and that the public really can inform everyone where they stand and how important it is for those of us who are in science policy in any way to understand what the concerns of the public are, because they're often of genuine reason and one has to be very attentive to them. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm from Chicago, as you can tell from my accent. While you adjust, I will give you a brief story. We moved here 15 years ago from the UK, and I was out doing some shopping in a local supermarket, and the girl at the checkout was being very friendly and chatty, as they are not in the UK, but as, of course, people are much more friendly here. And she said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm British. I probably said British then. And she said, how long have you been here? And I said, oh, less than 2 weeks. She said, your English is very good. Well, I'm afraid my English isn't quite as good now as it was then. But you won't guess. It's very nice to be here. I'm very grateful for the invitation to be party to this panel. I want to make three points, but I want to throw in a couple of sort of factoids at the beginning, which I think are perhaps significant and need to be there. Some of you will have seen the annual poll which Virginia Commonwealth University does of attitudes towards science. In the latest round of this poll, when asked the question, this is an American poll, when asked the question, have science and technology raised as many problems as they have solved? You get a yes from 54% of the American population. Factoid one. Factoid two. Some of you, and of course we have Europeans who know all about these things, but some of you have been following the European GMO food debate, debacle, fiasco, what I call the peasants' revolt from the Caucasus to the Atlantic, in which basically the markets for genetically modified foods were essentially destroyed by a combination of a failure of public confidence in public science and also, of course, in corporate technology and other factors. But it is the ultimate cautionary tale for those who want to believe in science and technology and promote it and address this nexus of questions. And third, just a throwaway, because tomorrow, Zeke and I are having a further discussion about one of these questions, which is the stem cell question, which I won't say much about except this, in that many people do not know that there's been just as big a debate about stem cell research and embryos in Europe as there has been here, and that, in fact, the center of gravity in the European discussions is not that far away from the center of gravity in the U.S. administration on these issues. So these actually are global questions, and, of course, where we come into this, and this has already been alluded to, would be much too weak a term for what my esteemed colleague on my left was saying. I mean, the abortion debate has essentially crippled our capacity in the U.S. to discuss anything else. And I think the toxic effects of the abortion debate, and we all have convictions on the abortion question, not my point, the toxic effect of the abortion debate on American public discourse, I think, is going to be increasingly problematic for our capacity to discuss the fundamental questions being raised by these emerging technology issues. Three brief particular points. One is, in a sense, it's almost a trivial point. I mean, yes, of course. I mean, you can't avoid government engagement in science because, of course, government is funding so much basic research. But beyond that, increasingly the questions being raised in science and technology are affecting our lives in ways which have social policy implications, moral implications, that were far, far less true of the older science projects. And this is something I'm sure we will come back to. But there's an inevitability, if we have a democracy, about accountability. And ultimately, everything is decided by appropriations committees, which ultimately give the communities validation or not on what it is public science and public technology is to be. And this is simply a truism. I'm not making a partisan point here. This is how it works. And if we take the view that in a democracy, it's only ultimately the values of the community which can legitimately be mediated through the governmental process. I mean, there's no other source, it seems to me, for authority in government than, of course, the people. then this is a truism of some significance and of which needs not to be undermined by wishful thinking, because one dislikes the way in which particular policies are developed because people feel different ways to the way that one feels on these questions. And I think that's at the heart of this. Second point. Questions, of course, raised by S&T policy, science and technology policy, are increasingly going far beyond the simple sort of research and development areas which traditionally they have encompassed. And this is the point that Dorothy was making about you know, the difference between, you know, the space project and nuclear issues and so on and so forth, and some of these emerging technologies. But, I mean, it isn't just that they have obvious moral implications of another kind. It is that they raise fundamental questions about intellectual property, for example. Not least with the passage of, you know, Bayh-Dole and tech transfer, and the fact that so many people in science now are, in fact, you know, either very wealthy or hoping to be, with research basically done on the public dime and so on. But the whole IP debate, I mean, the whole issue of gene patents, patents on human embryos, I mean, these questions are extraordinarily huge. The whole question of genetic discrimination, which, of course, is something everyone's against, but it's been quite difficult to come up with legislative responses. But, I mean, the implications of what you do with the information. It's all about information, the information society. What we do with the information we now have garnered for us through these new technologies. And, you know, on every one of these questions, we're just going up this exponential curve. And just where you are and you know, and so on, how you present the curve and where you put it on the PowerPoint is so much a matter for subjective judgment. And if you believe, you know, Ray Kurzweil's stuff about the singularity and so on, then we're going way up a very steep curve. You can divide by 10, and you've still got a very interesting situation, very, very different to that of a generation ago, when science was so much more, if you like, domesticated. And allied with that, of course, the question of commodification questions. Many of us are very concerned about the trade in women's eggs and oocytes. Of course, you know, you can get $100,000 if you're really, really smart and pretty to sell your eggs to somebody who wants to have a smart, pretty child, and they hope that genetics works the way they think it works. But, I mean, women in third world countries are having their eggs traded across national boundaries. I mean, this is an issue. The whole question, of course, of organs and trade in organs. And the one thing on which virtually everybody in bioethics agreed 10, 15 years ago was that we don't use organs as commodities. We don't put cash value on them. That consensus is now cracking. And ultimately, we may well have international trade in kidneys, for example, which poor people sell kidneys to get their kids through college. I mean these questions go way beyond the sort of question of what science do we fund. But they're all science and tech issues. And global policy implications, of course, are very hard to follow through. Some of you may know, although I doubt whether very many of you know, that UNESCO, which is probably the logical place to do some of these things, even though it isn't an agency which has found much favor in this country, but we rejoined a number of years ago at Mr. Bush's initiative, much to the surprise of many people. UNESCO last fall passed the Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights, which is the first global instrument addressing many of these questions. It's a consensus document. That's how they work in UNESCO. But I think it's very interesting, and there's some very interesting things in it that I think are really rather good. But there are frameworks in place, but these are things that nobody hears about, and therefore they have no political sort of salience. Ultimately, they're all global issues. Thirdly, as we look ahead, and I'm, you know, making my own projection here, I take the view that science and technology issues are going to be the dominant issues of our politics in the next generation. Far from being things you can get out of the way, so the scientists can get on with running their affairs, as pretty much like the medieval church, as a state within a state, which in a sense is the model for the profession model for science. I think because of the way in which, if you like, science and technology increasingly are focusing ad intra rather than ad extra. I mean, we're concerned about human nature, about the human condition, about human enhancements. I was at a seminar a few weeks ago convened by one of the national labs talking about cognitive enhancements. I mean, these things are now being, you know, the notion of having Google in your brain, having a BlackBerry in your brain. These questions, at one level, are kind of sci-fi, you know, fun. Well, it's a liberty issue if you really want to do that. But you run the movie. And I think we will see the emergence, if we go down that track, of radical human enhancement of what I call the new feudalism. because you will essentially be compounding the economic and political power of a very small number of people who are the beneficiaries of these technologies. And therefore, the most dramatic social implications in every country, and not just sort of West, you know, versus developing world, but in every country, you will see a gross compounding of inequities in a way that ultimately may find lead to a reshaping of much of our politics. And then I think this is going to bring the conscientious left and the conscientious right together on these questions. And the sort of the more libertarian, or perhaps the more naive, or perhaps the more, you know, coarsely pro-business, who cares, communities, which are spread right across the traditional political left-right spectrum, I think ultimately may be the ones who are on the other side. And the sort of communitarians of left and right will find common cause in these questions. Very difficult here in the US to have this conversation because of the abortion question. In Europe, it's much more the conversation which is emerging. I mean, I had dinner a little while ago with a friend of mine who is a green German member of the European Parliament. I mean, in that context, you know, we can have these conversations very openly. Much more complex here. But you heard this from me, these issues will, in fact, dominate our political culture in the next generation. And we've got to find a way to structure our rhetoric and our institutions so that we can develop biopolicy and broader technology policy without the kind of tectonic sort of shifts which we have been experiencing in the last few years, which have made it very hard even to have this conversation. Thank you.
Okay, good. Let's see. I'm almost tempted to spend my time talking about what you just talked about, but maybe we'll get to it. I want to return to some of the things, in some sense, that Neil brought up. Neil and I have been involved together in a number of initiatives, and when we appear together, we usually try to take the role of good cop, bad cop. And our personalities naturally fall in a certain range, and so you can imagine what role I'll take. But what Neil referred to, and Dorothy to some extent, of the politicization of science is, again, I think they were being far too polite. The situation is extreme. There are attacks on science at every area of government, which I'm aware. I just pick two quotes, which I think kind of give a sense of the shift. They're both from Republican administrations, because I want to indicate strongly believe that while this administration is guilty of a tremendous amount, this issue is not a Democratic or Republican issue. So the following quote it's from the father of our current president from 1990 to the National Academy of Sciences. He said, "Science, like any field of endeavor, relies on freedom of inquiry. And one of the hallmarks of that freedom is objectivity. Now more than ever, on issues ranging from climate change to AIDS research to genetic engineering to food additives, government relies on the impartial perspective of science for guidance." And that's the way it's supposed to be. Here's a quote from the current administration. "This administration looks at the facts and reviews the best available science based on what's right for the American people." Okay, you notice a subtle shift? Okay, you decide what's right for the American people, then you decide what science is appropriate, and then you work with it. Okay, and that, unfortunately, has had dramatic consequences. That is hurting the scientific enterprise in this country tremendously, hurting the economy, and I believe hurting our democracy, as I'll get to. This issue has caused such concern that the scientific community has risen up in many ways. Neil and I were part of a letter of 62 scientists in 2004 to the White House. That letter had involved 20 Nobel laureates, 19 National Medal of Science winners, and four former science advisors to Republican and Democratic administrations. And now that group has increased to 50 Nobel laureates, 63 National Medal of Science recipients, and 175 members of the National Academies of Science. And I don't want to read the whole statement, but basically it says that the application of science has played a large part in the policies that have made the United States the world's most powerful nation and its citizens increasingly prosperous and healthy. This input should always be weighed from an objective and impartial perspective to avoid perilous consequences. This principle has been adhered to by presidents and administrations of both parties in forming and implementing policies. The administration of George W. Bush, however, has disregarded this principle. When scientific knowledge has been found to be in conflict with its political goals, the administration has often manipulated the process, through which science enters its decisions. This has been done by placing people who are unqualified professionally on, or with clear conflicts of interest on professional on scientific advisory panels, by disbanding existing advisory panels of scientists, by censoring and suppressing reports of governments of scientists, and simply by not seeking independent scientific advice. Other administrations, of course, have engaged in these policies, and that's important. I mean, this has always been the case to some extent, but not so systematically or on so wide a front. Furthermore, in advocating policies that are not scientifically sound, the administration has sometimes misrepresented scientific knowledge and misled the public about the implications of its policies. Those are serious words, and these are for people to get that many Nobel laureates, that many National Medal of Science winners, who represent all political persuasions to say that the situation's serious. And we called on, in fact, the Congress to pass legislation that would forbid censorship, really simple stuff, forbid censorship of scientific studies unless there's a reasonable national security concern, require all scientists on scientific advisory panels to meet high professional standards, ensure public access to government studies and the findings of scientific advisory panels. We've asked for that legislation to be passed. It has not been yet passed. On issues, let me give you just some examples. Well, you've all heard about issues of global warming and perhaps the suppression of scientific advice. In fact, in September 2002, the section on global warming was removed from the administration's annual report on the state of air pollution. And in fact, in June 2003, the administration's comprehensive report on the environment had no mention of climate change. An earlier draft did have it. It was taken out. And an EPA internal document said that after editing, the section, quote-unquote, no longer accurately reflects scientific consensus on climate change. This occurs in all sorts of areas. You mentioned the National Cancer Institute. As you may remember, for a little while after this administration came in, the statement saying that there were no connections between abortion and subsequent breast cancer was removed from the NCI website. There was such an outcry of scientists that there was, in fact, in that case, a conference that was organized, and in fact, the evidence was there was no connection between abortion and breast cancer, and it was put back in. In other areas, which are equally ideologically derived, for example, condom use and sex education, this directly affects the health and safety of children in this country and around the world. The CDC had an initiative called Programs That Work. It identified sex education programs that scientific studies had found to be effective. Okay. None of these studies involved abstinence only, which is the policy of the current administration. Okay. None of them scientifically involved abstinence only. In 2002, the CDC ended that initiative and removed all information about those programs that work, those sex education programs that work, from its web pages, because it disagreed with an ideological policy. And of course, in 2003, the president's press secretary said, in fact, abstinence is more than sound science. It has a proven track record. Indeed, it has a proven track record. It fails if it's the only kind of sex education used. And if you're concerned about the health and welfare of our children of this country, you should use science to improve it. I could go on. There have been tremendous litmus tests that have removed Nobel laureates from scientific advisory committees and removed whole scientific advisory committees themselves. Very important ones for the security of the nation. The National Nuclear Security Administration External Technical Advisory Committee, abolished. The Arms Control Panel that advises the State Department of Technical Matters was dismissed. These are serious concerns. At the same time, I mean, I agree, we really have to realize that in all of our policies, science and technology are a vital part of pretty well every political issue today. And I think that I'll probably get to some of these other points, and I really want to get on, but I would just say that to me, this is a vital issue not just for science, but when one listens to the discussions that are going on at this week, and I've listened to a lot of them, of democracy and liberty, that ignorance and censorship, I would argue, are the greatest threats to our liberty and our democracy. You can't have a viable democracy if neither the public nor legislators are informed appropriately. And therefore, we neglect science at our peril. We censor it at our peril. Not only are our health and security threatened, but the credibility and viability of our government itself is threatened, I would argue. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to ask a few questions, and then we'll go to the audience. So just hold that question for a second. I want to challenge you then.
Excellent.
If, in fact, science is so pivotal, if, in fact, this sort of tension between politics and science is, in some sense, inherent, what do you think we should do? What kind of solution should we have? Should we try to insulate scientists as much as possible from politics, or should we have some other way of handling this? And I put this question to you because you yourself acknowledge this is not unique to this administration. I was present when the Clinton administration got some advice about use of, I think it was embryos in research, and even before the report made it from the NIH to the White House, there was a decision not to actually listen to the report and do something else. So,
okay.
Solutions.
Okay. Let me just question what you just said for one thing. Absolutely, it's part of all administrations. This letter was never written for other administrations because the depth and breadth of this interference is so immense that scientists who are normally, and most scientists are normally extremely hesitant to comment on these issues, especially, I mean, Nobel laureates get asked to sign a million petitions every week, and they just don't, okay, because they have to be very careful. This is qualitatively quite different. I know Neil can comment on that as well. But I think we argued, and I think there are some simple things to do. Policy, it's up to the government to determine policy. And so I think governments have a right, the Bush administration has a right to make a decision on stem cells or abortion, if they wish, okay? I mean, that's in principle what they were appointed to do. But as opposed to elected, I would say. But what we require is that policy be based on sound science. So what we have to insulate is the scientific results, not the scientists. And the three or four proposals that, in fact, Henry Waxman has proposed that there be legislation, just requiring these simple things that all that essentially
they would do it though, they would be strong enough.
Well, in fact, as a result, I like to think in part of what we've done. In fact, the Bush administration has passed one piece of legislation which said that, in fact, there should not be litmus tests because, in fact, several major scientific committees, there was evidence that people on the committees were asked who they voted for. And if they did not vote for the president, they were removed from the committee.
Jesus.
And now there's, in fact, on January 3rd of this year, President Bush signed domestic spending legislation that contained a provision banning political litmus tests from federal scientific advisory panels. Those kind of things are simple and trivial, but they can have a profound impact. So I think what was being requested here was not something revolutionary. It was just saying, let's get the facts out so that logical policy decisions can be made.
Neil, you've been inside the government for a lot. Do you think this is going to create a big enough wall? I mean, granted that the wall is always going to have to be somewhat porous between science and politics, what would you recommend to try to, if you think we should, insulate science more from politics?
Well, I think, and I have said often that I think scientists need to be much more involved in policy, and you can't really do that unless you are to some extent involved in politics, because that's kind of our way of influencing policy decisions. There's always a risk that the scientists will then be viewed as just another constituency, just another pleading group. I think we're a long way from that danger. So we can keep an eye, but I really like Dorothy's view on this, but I think we can keep an eye on the situation as we go, but I really think we need to be much more involved. And of course, informing the public, but I actually mean trying to influence policy, and there are many ways to do that. Let me follow one point that Lawrence made, just to underscore it. What could the Bush administration have done in the case of climate change? They could have said, we're not going to sign Kyoto Protocol. Well, it's been signed. We're not going to move that forward. We're not going to try to get that ratified because we believe we don't know how to deal with the economic implications, and they could perhaps be very severe, and it could well destroy our country. There are all kinds of uncertainties about that. They did not have to manipulate the scientific record. They did not have to lie to the American people about what scientists actually have found and what the scientific consensus is. different issue, stem cells, just to underscore the issue. The administration made a decision, the president made a decision on embryonic stem cells, namely research can only be funded by NIH on what turns out to be a small number of stem cell lines that existed as of the day he made that decision, 2001, whatever it was, September or August. That's an example of what Lawrence was talking about now. So the administration, the Congress, they can make policy being informed by the science, and that's what we expect them to do. We will agree or disagree on the policy they made. All right. We can do that as citizens. As scientists, I think with our science hat on, either individually or collectively, what we really need to make sure is that the people are not misled on the science, and that the government, when they get ready to make these policy decisions, are accessing the best scientific information. That's what we complained about. There was nothing about stem cells in this statement that Lawrence referred to. And the reason was the administration, as far as we knew, did not, it's arguable a little bit, but did not mislead the public on what the benefits could be of scientific discovery. I mean, my successor, John Marburger, in the White House was very clear about that issue. The benefits can be enormous. If research is the only issue here, if science is the only issue, we would go forward on it. So I just want to emphasize the distinction between what we're complaining about here in this statement, and that's misleading the public and not availing themselves of the best science. That's extremely dangerous. And that then conveys the impression that the highest level of government, certainly President Bush, but it's true in the Congress, really appear to suggest that your opinion's as good as mine, mine's as good as yours. Science is not special in the sense of a body of knowledge and its potential benefits and the rigors about which that knowledge is derived and all the rest of it. Therefore, it can be manipulated like anything else can be politically manipulated. So I would say science has finally arrived where economics has been a long time. The federal government lies to the American people about economic implications, and that's probably not new. Now it's happened in science.
Dorothy, I want to pick up something that Neil said and see if you agree. I mean, one of the things he suggested is that scientists should become more political. Do you think that would be a good thing, or do you think that would actually make them look just like another interest group and therefore undercut the sort of the status they're trying to claim for themselves of being objective fact providers?
They have become political. I don't think we have the option to decide whether or not they should or shouldn't. They are a political force in some way. And I guess I... What?
Not a strong enough one.
Okay. But there, I thought I'd identify a couple of what I see as other cross-cutting tensions that exist in some of these debates. One is I chaired an advisory committee to the National Science Foundation, which is a major funder of science in this country with a stellar record. And what became clear to me was that people in Congress want their states to get equal funding. And so you were saying about whether or not it's scientific or not, it's just one more way of looking at things. The feeling is I am the congressperson from this area, and I want this big project in my area. And then you say, well, your university is really not ready to do something like that, and your good scientists want to go to Stanford or Caltech or MIT. No, this is an egalitarian society, and we have to spread science evenly across the states. So you think of that. I'm sure you had a lot of experience with that at NSF, of this is underlying a lot of what's going on in science, in the sense that it is one more pork barrel aspect that we're going to divide among the society. The other thing I'd just like to add again is a cross-cutting variable. Those of us whose best friends are scientists kind of think it's a pretty nifty group. But if you look at all of the images of scientists, if you look at the studies of what has a scientist looked like in movies beginning in 1920, it's pretty chilling. usually a Frankenstein. Margaret Mead began a series of studies on the public image of science, and it's been replicated many times. Always male, always white, always brilliant, always hair growing like Einstein's. Someone you want but don't trust him because he's quite crazy, basically. And so even though the public, I think, is somewhat more positive about science than some of those figures you saw, particularly when it comes to health, the notion is that this is a pretty unstable group. So you've got this cross-cutting and actually fitting into some of these more recent decisions that, well, art and music, they're all part of this kind of fringe culture along with science and not really the meat of the economics of government.
I think Dorothy's very right, as she usually is, in saying that there is this combination of a public misunderstanding and to some extent misperception of science that plays it. These things couldn't happen if we had a better informed public. If we had a government that's denied the existence of the Holocaust, people just wouldn't buy it because people basically have some fundamental historical perspective, I think. But you can have, but right now you can almost say anything you want in science, and people believe you, especially if you say you're a scientist, if you have a PhD, okay? And that is a huge problem, I think. And both you and Neil, I think, made a key point. If this is tied into not only perception of science, and in fact the distrust of science that you mentioned here is actually echoed in Europe. There was a recent study in Europe where science distrust decreased by 10%. There are places that are trying to do that. I just came back from Norway, and Norway has a concerted effort to get kids and have them draw pictures of scientists over years. And the amazing thing is, in 15 years of effort, they got, you know, the scientists used to look like what you said. They were male. They looked crazy. They had lab coats. Now they have women, and some of them are nicely dressed. It's really important, I think. And so we scientists have to play, I think, as well as becoming political. We are part of this problem by having been very well funded during the Cold War and saying we don't have to tell anybody what we're doing because we're going to get the money anyway. And physicists in particular, I think, you know, speaking as a physicist, have realized, you know, with the demise of the superconducting supercollider in Texas for stupid political reasons, that we did a poor job of explaining why we wanted to build it. And we need to not just become political, but we have to actually explain why it is the public should spend their money on these things, and we have to do a better job of it. And it's vitally important.
Nigel, can we separate the facts and the values this way, as Neil is suggesting, so that we can say here are the hard facts, but our values lead us to a different place?
Well, the notion that, you know, that there are these facts out there, and you know that the scientists know them, and by a majority at least they vote, and so on. I mean, on one level this is how things operate. At another level, we all know it is riddled with all sorts of philosophical problems. And scientists are very often wrong, and the majority of scientists typically have always been wrong, which is why, you know, paradigm shift and so on and so forth. I'm a little wary of this sort of fact thing. I'm not aware of facts. I'm aware of this fact thing by which I am referring to the proposition being made here. It does seem to me that we come back to this notion of an informed public, and not least of an informed press. And I think one of our big, big problems here, and I'm sure there are some science journalists here, and I have great admiration for what they often try and do, but typically, you know, this is the science guy, and he has to write about everything, or she has to write about everything. And it comes up, you know, and you get on the phone to this person, and, you know, I mean, and the quotes go in, and that's it. Now, the press essentially is the only way. I mean, you can do what you like with K-12, and we all agree there are huge things we've got to do. But the press basically is what ultimately mediates the democracy. And particularly in areas of sort of technical, quasi-technical education, it is the press that is really the only context for these conversations. I mean, I'll just throw in a sort of controversial analogy or example. I mean, it seems to me, if you're talking about pathologies, I mean, Proposition 71 in California was the most pathological thing I think we've seen for a long, long time.
Tell people what Proposition 71 is.
This was a proposition passed on the ballot at the same time as the last presidential election, whereby the people of cash-strapped California voted $3 billion to create a constitutional right for stem cell research, quote-unquote, and were assured by its proponents that within 5 years, and the bond structure is such that there are no capital repayments for 5 years, they would be making bigger savings in the California healthcare budget because of all the cures. Now, even this is quote-unquote. I wrote an op-ed in the San Fran Chronicle just before the vote. For some reason, it didn't swing the vote. And I said, if you made those claims in an IPO, you'd go to jail. But they, and even, and now all the people who are proposing, I mean, they admitted, well, you know, we were just, you know, and because they outspent the other side by 100-1 on television. Now, my point is, I mean, this sort of pathological politicizing of science is not the prerogative of any one sector of our political culture.
Okay. Back there, you've been very patient.
It's relevant to your line of questions.
Well, just tell us who you are so we all know.
I'm Jack Griggs. I work on the Energy and Environment Program at the Aspen Institute. The point that Neil Lane started with and that this has gone to, and that's how scientists should get more involved in the political process. And I want to suggest that maybe harder than it sounds. Mm-hmm. I worked for Congress for many years. We wanted scientific advice. We would invite the best scientists to testify. And they could be so opaque. I'm sure it was the kind of a statement that would go over well in a scientific meeting, but these laymen in Congress couldn't understand it. And so there is a challenge for a scientist to learn to speak simply and clearly without distorting the science. And we had a dialogue here at the Institute last summer on journalism and the environment, specifically focusing on climate change. Why don't journalists write about it more, and can they learn science, and can scientists be credible? Purposes and so on, do we have to have this on the one hand, on the other hand? And the journalists basically said that it was very difficult for them to get scientists to talk to them. And when they did, it was very difficult to get them to say something concrete and decisive. Everything was always qualified. We found that in Congress, too. Scientists never think an issue is settled. And I understand that. It's part of the scientific method. Scientists also always in every statement before Congress with a request for more research money, whatever the question is. So did every other
ministry. Well, I will say one thing that the NIH has done is to give many of its senior scientists speaker training. I don't know whether that helps or not, but I actually give all of my trainees speaker training because I think it's exact. That is a very important point. You have to be able to communicate.
That came up in a follow-on meeting that the Yale School of Environment had here in the fall. The academics in the group with the journalists said that there are no rewards for an academic to get involved in the process. If you speak simply enough that the politicians and the public can understand you, you kind of
disincentive
with your scientific colleagues. And if you're trying to get tenure, there are no rewards for an op-ed or for testimony before Congress. So how can scientists make this work?
I was going to bring up. I mean, you hit a very important point. There was a panel yesterday where they talked where Boeing was spending money bringing engineers into the schools. And I said beforehand, it's very important that you don't bring all engineers into the schools because some of them will just make it worse. It's really important that not all scientists speak before the public. Okay, because there are different skills. Brian Green's here, and he and I'm. Pleased to be part of a project he's working on in New York for a science festival in 2008, and we both agreed when talking together that it's important to be quite selective about which scientists you get because different people have different communication skills. But the scientific community is huge, and there are scientists who can communicate, and those people have a special responsibility, I think, to do it. And you're absolutely right. I think there are disincentives to doing that. I mean, I've experienced it personally, and I'm sure others have. And one has to, at the same time, I think those are decreasing because as the scientific community feels itself more at risk, and at risk for parochial reasons, funding if nothing else, the level of support I get when I'm speaking out about science from my colleagues has been great. And I think you're seeing that as people feel science itself is threatened, there's much more support going into to support people who can speak out. I mean, I'll give you a frank example. I don't have a Nobel Prize. I'm not a National Medal of Science winner, but I was in that group of 60, and I think I was in that group of 60 because people had seen me speaking out about that and felt that I could communicate. So I think that is beginning to happen.
Okay, we got a lot of people, and try to be quick, and we'll try to be quick as well. I can see who you are, and we'll go.
I totally agree with the emphasis that Nigel has put that science and technology issues are going to dominate most of the global and national issues. Now, if that is true, we need to make sure that science and technology can preserve a few people in a diverse society. For example, ideally what would be great in this country is to have the numbers at MIT, Caltech, and Stanford reflect national demographics. 50% of the professors who are tenured at this place should be women. 54% should be black, for example. Because if we don't do that, then the resolution, the impact of the certain technology issues on the major debates will be skewed because they won't reflect the demographics of society. So what is the role of government in this country to make sure the demographics of our PhDs at MIT, our tenured professors at Caltech reflect the demographics of the country?
Neil.
Well, I think, I agree completely with the comment that was made, and I think we scientists have failed miserably, in a way, in addressing issues of representation for that we needed to work on for a whole variety of reasons, including fairness and so on, but just the health and vigor of science and especially its use throughout the world. We've not figured out how to do that. I think part of that is just discrimination. I think all of us, can't speak for you, but there's some part of us that even unknowingly, I mean, no matter how we were raised or what our feelings are, discriminate. I mean, feel, have certain biases that influence us in subtle ways. And of course, some people it's not so subtle, but in many ways it is subtle. The federal government, I think, has a very important role to play, and it's been pushed way into kind of non-existent in this administration. And in the past administration, even though the White House, the executive branch, was very much in favor of the federal government being explicitly involved in trying to address the issues you raise through federal programs, through peer review, through criteria, in a variety of other ways, helped nudge this issue along. The Congress, of course, was already controlled by people who have a different point of view, who believe that this is not an important issue or the federal government does not have a role. And so, you know, public policy at the level of those branches of government in the last decade or so, even longer, has moved away from addressing this issue. And then courts, you know, the Fifth Circuit Court, for example, in its decision. So there are problems in the courts as well. So I'm just expressing a view that I think the federal government has a key role here, and it isn't going to happen. We're not going to make progress unless the federal government explicitly takes this on again and said, now, wait a minute. You know, 20 years ago, we worried about this issue, and we put in place programs and conditions and constraints to try to help. And how come we changed our minds? I mean, what's really improved in this situation? Well, not much. Some improvement on the gender imbalance in some fields, virtually no improvement with regard to representation of other ethnic groups, including African Americans and Hispanics and so on, in science and engineering enterprise in this country, not to mention the implications for the rest of the world. It's a serious issue.
Dorothy, you wanted to?
Yeah, not surprisingly, I've been working on these issues for many, many years and had a huge grant in the early 1970s to try to explore how to get more women and minorities onto faculty roles, both as administrators and as scientists. And then consciousness raising really made a difference. And I don't want to play it down. I think asking questions like that, I would go into the office of a full professor and say, we're looking for a woman professor in X. And he would say, well, I don't know any. And then you talk some more and he'd say, you know what? She's been a research associate here for 15 years. There's no reason she shouldn't be a professor. And that was the beginning of an awareness. Fortunately, at that time, the National Science Foundation was funding people to help make the difference. And they've cut out those funds. There were these wonderful grants for summer camps where you could identify young people of color, by gender, or oddness, kids who weren't fitting in high school. Mitch Kapor, whom I wrote an article about for the London Times, said to me he was this weird kid in high school, and he got a National Science Foundation summer camp grant, and that changed his life. He went on to develop Lotus Notes. And again, I think there is an unconscious bias. It still exists. People like to replicate themselves. It's one of the reasons why you want women and minorities on every single group you're in, not the token woman, not the token black, but a sense that normality consists of different ratios from the ones that we have now. And so I think the question is one that's very much with us, and unfortunately, the very mechanisms we've had in place are now not being funded.
Hot button topic. Every speaker wants to talk about it.
Now, you have hit an important topic, but I want to follow up on what Dorothy said a little bit, and Neil. It's very important that we have equal opportunities in science as well as everywhere else in our society, I think. But I firmly and strongly believe, as a university administrator, I've been a chair of a department for many years and hiring people, that you can't solve this problem at the highest levels. You can't solve. You can't start by requiring the proper demographics that people have to be hired. You have to do this at the level of education. You have to provide the educational opportunities, the incentives, and the motivation. And you know, I've gone in, and that's a much deeper problem. I've gone into my wife, who's here, volunteers in the Cleveland Public Schools, and I've gone in to the inner city schools to talk about. What is a scientist? What do you have to do? They have no idea of even what career path, how to get from A to B. It's so far removed for kids in the inner cities here. And if you want to try and create the appropriate demographic pool at the research level, you've got to start by doing a better job of education at a fundamental level. And that's a much deeper problem and a profoundly important one.
Three quick points. I mean, I'm not disagreeing substantively with anything anybody's saying here. I mean, I think there are real difficulties in finding out how you get there, and we've tried all sorts of things, and we're a long way from getting where we want to be. But I certainly think that the education question, both in the sort of K-12 education question and the public education question about science and the role models for science, which are purveyed in the press and in the other media, I think these things are profoundly significant. And I think turning around the kind of social assumptions which have so much dominated our culture. And, you know, those of us who would be more socially conservative than others, shall we say, can absolutely buy into this agenda. And it seems to me, I mean, I happen to have a particularly high view of women's capacity, not least as managers and so on. And it seems to me that there are very interesting reasons why in a lot of areas they just don't get those opportunities. And sad to say, this is prejudice. And ultimately, my sense is that, if I can just make a little personal comment, most of our organizations are going to end up being run by women because they tend much more to have the kind of mix of skills that men have to go and work on and learn. And certainly if you're looking at competencies, we have systems and attitudes in our culture which do not allow the sort of meritocratic principles we talk about to operate.
Next question.
I'm Margaret Cohen. Retired professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. So quite a bit has been said, and I've heard and learned quite a bit. And partly I'd like to connect with the things that have been said and partly bring out perhaps a few different perspectives. We made a film starting about 3 years ago. It was shown last night. A few of you were there. It's been shown since last October, first in Washington, at the premiere in Washington. Lots of Washington types were there. We were careful to invite a lot of people who we thought would connect with that film. And the film's done very well in most respects, not in one respect. And I want to tell you a quick story. Well, perhaps I should say, why did I get into this? I mean, that's the most remote thing.
Tell us what the film is. I'm not sure everyone knows. But tell them what the film is.
The film is called The Power of the Sun, and it deals, it emphasizes solar energy as an important candidate for alleviating the huge energy crisis we are plowing into. But within a broader energy context. Okay, why did I get into that? Well, I was on the Science Advisory Committee of the Department of Energy. I've been on it for, I think, 7 years now. You may say, well, what could I have done? In any case, when Ray Orbach was appointed as the director of the Office of Science in the Department of Energy. He came and talked to our committee. And I listened to this. And so he talked about various things that they had in mind, building new facilities and so on. And then he talked about energy. I mean, the energy, oil from fossil fuels, etc. And I will skip all the details except to say he went along chronologically and he came to 2050 and said about then fusion is going to kick in and period. I mean, he did not talk beyond 2050 simply because fusion was there. I couldn't believe it. I've been watching this fusion business for, I guess, 40 years. And
it's almost 25 years. Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, roughly speaking, right, a constant during all this period was that with luck, it will be commercial in 30 years. And at the time Orbach was speaking, that's what people were saying again. Now we have, by the way, in fusion, we have fortunately this big international collaboration. And my friends, the friends that I trust most that are connected with us, tell me, well, we are fairly optimistic that unless we run into some obstacles we don't dream of yet, maybe by the end of the century, be about 15% of the energy needs. Okay. So I sort of became just frustrated. I've done a little bit of helping to the laboratory here in Golden on national renewable energy. But finally, we said to ourselves, some friends, we just try and approach the public. And approach the public in a way, hopefully, that they will absorb, right? Somebody made the remark, I forget who, just a minute ago, that, yes, you in the back there, that sometimes this scientific advice just is reflected back 100%. So one remark is, films or television, right, are really an important medium, and scientists have not used them much. The Gore film, of course, is a spectacular example of that.
Do you have a question?
Yes.
All right.
No, I have better than a question. I have a proposal.
All right.
Anybody can ask questions. My proposal is a small proposal, but based on our experience. If you get totally frustrated with the federal government and say, well, we can't do anything until maybe there's a change of government, in the meantime, you can work with state governments, you can work with city governments, and you can make a hell of a lot of difference. I mean, everybody knows that particularly the state of California in the energy business has a global impact. And one can work with them. The federal government did not give us one penny for our film. The state government funded more than one third of it. So that's
good.
Walter, your point is very well taken, and I think you're seeing in the absence of federal action on a lot of issues, including global warming issues and stem cell research, state governments taking the slack. There is a counter view here, however. First of all, many state and especially local governments are struggling now with this economy and are far less able. If we start diverting funding from the federal government to state and local levels, as we have in education, for example, it often tends to reduce the federal support, or at least it puts it on the people who sometimes have the fewest resources. At the same time, it also works, and something else I meant to say, is that this attack on science is not just happening at federal levels. I live in Ohio, and I've had to waste a few years of my life trying to make sure our kids learn biology, because it's at the state and local level there are people trying who are so afraid that if kids learn about science they will lose their faith that they'd rather have the kids be ignorant, and so that's another problem at the state and local level.
Next question. Hold on, we have to move around.
Okay. I know this is supposed to be next. Politics and science.
No.
But under the what I've been listening to from our experts, there seems to be an underlying religious factor that is absolutely politicizing the White House and Congress to do the things that they're doing, what I will say is anti-science. Do you believe that a fresh administration and perhaps a different Congress would change their ideas about science?
Yep. The man with
well, the most... I would like to run the experiment.
But not a randomized trial.
I do. Many of you may have read Kevin Phillips' American Theocracy. The chapter on religion I find very illuminating and helps me understand, I think in ways that aren't really going to be disputed by anybody on either side of the issue, how a religion has been a certain, right-wing, very conservative minority of American society has become so powerful. And not just recently, but over a long period of time, and we're seeing it more explicitly recently. So I would just agree. I think it has had a major impact. But it gives me also a chance to say that this set of problems and this condition that we're in right now, that many of us feel we're in, not just about science, but a lot of other issues as well, being so strongly influenced by a small minority of American people of faith. We cannot afford to let this become a science versus religion issue.
Exactly.
And, Ed Wilson spoke to that issue in a very articulate way earlier, and many thoughtful people have done so. And Lawrence, who's been out on the dealing with the issue of intelligent design and evolution, has been careful, probably bending over backwards, biting his tongue, whatever the term is, to make clear this should not be a putting of religion against science. I mean, that whole society is going to lose on that, and Ed made that point, I think, very clearly. One of the problems is some of the scientists are so out there on their overt atheistic view that they have a much larger impact and make the public believe that all scientists somehow are captured by those views. I think we have a serious issue, and it has to do with communication. It has to do with a lot of things we've been talking about.
Yeah, a couple of comments. I mean, one is that the...
obviously, yeah. Once you set things up as science versus religion, it seems to me everybody loses every time. It is the case, of course, that, I mean, you've spoken about small minorities and so on and so forth. I mean, ultimately, all societies are run by engaged minorities. We know that. And we call the main engaged minority the elite. And, half of them are here in Aspen this week. So, I think there needs to be a certain sort of sense of proportion in this conversation. What has tended to happen, I think, in American society, and I see this in many ways as a European, because things work very differently there, much more sort of analogically, is you've had a disruptive role for a large minority that sees itself as disenfranchised in all sorts of ways from the culture, tends not to be represented in elite conversation and so on and so forth, and has found recourse to the ballot box as a way to influence policy in a way that has been disruptive rather than, if you like, organic. And I think that's merely an observation. And it seems to me that not least we need to find much better ways to incorporate those who see themselves in that way into the national conversation.
I just want to also say that I think I disagree with you virtually completely, and although you might think I agree with you. I don't think this, from what I've said before, I think this is a question of science versus ideology, not science versus religion. This is a question of people who decide they know the answer, and then they pick and choose the information that validates that answer. And that is antithetical to the way science is done and to the way proper policy should be done. And it's not this, sometimes there's a religious motivation, but for many, many of the things we're seeing, it's just they've decided what the answer is and will only choose the information that's appropriate to it. And that's what we have to fight.
Hold on. There's we do need to maintain some order here.
I don't want to serve as a lightning rod.
Why not?
Because it's not like I came here, otherwise I'd probably be sitting up on the panel. But for 3.5 years, I served as the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Health.
What is your name?
Dr. Zucker, Howard Zucker. And now I sit for science, technology, and medicine in an apolitical spot. And I just want to say that it's not as clear-cut as you may all put it out to be. Because I do know personally from projects that I worked on that went forth pro-science, trying to push the agenda forward, tissue engineering, regenerative medicine, and many things like that, which if you looked on the website and HHS, you'd find it there, that went right up to the president. I know this person firsthand. And that would then come back down as the system works into OSTP. My co-author and I tried to get this published. We finally got it published. But one of the leading medical journals decided they were not going to publish it. Part of the reason they did not publish it because it did not fit their agenda, what they were trying to push. And those journals are supposed to be good science, good. For that part, it was just a proposal. It ended up in the President's Council as one of the four proposals that went up to Congress. It was not published because it didn't fit with the agenda of what the journal wanted, which is another issue which we could bring up.
Did they tell you that?
Why? Because I do know that one of the senior players, or the editors of one of the journals, and I don't want to say which one, was supporting the campaign of Kerry, and word filtered back around that this is not going to be moved forward. And a very good proposal, but the issue also is, as I went to Congress to present that and to brief members of Congress, 42 people sat there, and it brings up what you brought up before. And we put the proposal together, presented it in very clear ways, and not one question was raised by any member of the staffers, because some of those staffers are sitting there in positions which I will say, I will question whether they also, and this is on both sides of the aisle, whether they themselves should be sitting in those positions making some of these judgments that then go back to members of Congress and say, well, what do you think about this? Well, I sat in the briefing and I don't think it's good. That's how some of the issues we need to address.
I have to disagree with you in that last sentence. So I've testified before Congress, and as much as I sometimes get frustrated with government, when I go there, it almost reinforces my faith in democracy, in the sense that, though, you know, I'm amazed at how hard the staffers work, and the quality of the questioning that I get, which may not come from the Congress people themselves. And I think that they are, every time I've tried to provide information, they've been eager to listen. That's just been my experience.
And I agree with you that they do work hard. I'm telling you, some of these things are getting much more complicated than somebody who's maybe got 2 years of graduate degree and decided to spend the summer working in Congress because of whatever reasons. These are much more complicated issues.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a question for each of the panelists specifically.
Could tell us more.
Nate Lewis, I am a scientist. I'm one of the tenured professors at Caltech. So it seems to me actually very interested to see how many people are in this room. That's a very gratifying thing, see how many people are concerned about this issue in the first place. So that's very good. Seems to me that it's clear that the underlying theme at all levels here is education. If we had enough education at the decision-making level, that the scientists wouldn't be concerned about filtering because it would be a policy filter with scientific informed facts at the policy level. If we had education at the K-12 level, we wouldn't be so concerned about the minority and gender issues because they would be percolating up in the systems. The question is, I know Brian does this through TV. I tried to go around the country talking to people about the science of climate change recently, involved with the California ballot initiative like Walter is, try to do something on renewable energy. But it's pretty frustrating. No matter how much you do, you can only reach a very limited set of people in a very different way. You know, more people are going to hear Barry Bonds and his problems in 1 week than are ever going to hear about the scientific issues that we can promulgate. So if, instead of turning this into a kind of gripe session, if you could all individually wave a magic wand and help construct some scenario that would fix this problem, what actions ought we to be taking that would fix it?
I'll begin. We can go that way. So.
I'll get you one story. Okay, you got. But I think that. It is very frustrating, but there are a vast number of scientists, and I think that everyone has a responsibility at some level. And people are there's some people who are going to be communicating on TV, but there are other people who are going to be communicating in their churches, in their schools. And I think that so what I tell scientists that we have to be evangelists for science. Because everywhere else in the society, there are people being evangelists against science in many different ways. And so if the vast majority of the scientific community took it as responsibility to go into their local communities and work at a school board level or other levels, it could have an impact. And not everyone has to try to have a global impact. And I'll just quote something from Eugenie Scott, who said, "The First Amendment protects against the government establishment of religion, but that doesn't mean it will protect against bad science. The only protection we have against bad science is if scientists take responsibility, every one of us, to go into our communities."
Right. There's a volunteerist suggestion.
I'm wary of this evangelism for science stuff. I mean, it seems to me this is the kind of war of science and religion or science versus. I mean, it seems to me what we need to do is to recognize that, first of all, we live in this profoundly conservative religious country, whether we like it or not. Which, compared to any European country, of course, this country is about 10 times as religious. And you may not like it, you may not believe this stuff, but I mean, that is the context of the conversation. In which there is a major disenfranchise, the word that I want to come back to, community which has not seen itself as being party to these conversations. And I think this is a huge problem, not least because I think there are many misunderstandings there. And if we can develop the kind of civil discourse, civil in both senses, on these questions of the implications of science and technology, then we will find there's much more common ground out there than we might have believed. But one thing we have to do is to take the abortion debate off the table. Because otherwise, it ends up destroying the possibility of any conversation. So, whereas we can't take it off the table, you know, in the public arena, for the purposes of these conversations, we have conceptually to pretend it isn't there, and then look at how the world looks without that issue haunting all of these conversations, and build civil discourse around a table like this, in which we take it for granted that we're pro-science, because science ultimately is all about our enabling us, ourselves, as humans, to fulfill our humanness.
Dorothy, your suggestion.
I guess, even though I've spent years arguing why we need more scientists and engineers, I think there's a larger problem than that. And I guess my feeling is, for example, we have a surplus of PhDs in biology. It's hard to realize, as we talk about this, that many are unemployed. They've got second-rate careers now. They've become perpetual postdoctoral fellows looking for money. They become intellectual gypsies running around the country trying to get teaching gigs. So I think focusing just on getting more people into science and engineering is going to get us into trouble. So my argument would be that what we have to do is create an environment in which we understand more about the role of science and technology in society. And in doing so, simultaneously do what we've been talking about is improving teaching, education, et cetera, K through 12. I'm more pessimistic, I think, than some of my colleagues are about what this minority is in fundamentalism in our country. I think it's growing very rapidly. It's well-funded. I don't think it's just a minority group. And in fact, I can see I've already been swept into it myself this week with the high level of conversation about what's going on in religion, that when Professor Wolf talked about the power of the sun, I heard it S-O-N. And I think and so I feel we are really in an environment now that is stimulating us to think in somewhat different terms. And so that providing a context within which to understand science is just as important as producing more scientists.
Well, of course, I don't know the answer to Nate's provocative question. I agree with the very excellent points that have been made. If I knew the answer, I'd have $100,000 honorarium fee and finally buy my Jaguar that I've been wanting to call. A hybrid Jaguar.
Made out of only the
But let me just pick one piece that kind of resonates with several of the points that have been made and with what Walter's doing and what Nate is doing. I do agree and should have said, in my own comments, and I appreciate Dorothy emphasizing dialogue is really the critical word here in terms of science interacting with society. I have many colleagues in Texas who were born in East Texas, and they go out, they were Baptists at some point, at least, and they go into those churches and talk about stem cells. And of course, they're not well received for their message. They're well received because they're a member of the community. And so we need much more of that. But more specifically, while we're waiting on government, while we're waiting to run this experiment that I suggested we might run, each of us is a member of one or more scientific societies that are not connected with government. We have our own set of political issues inside all those societies. But in principle, the American Physical Society, with the American Chemical Society, with the Biological Society's medical organization, could come together. I tried very hard to make some of this happen when I was in Washington. It's an uphill slog because budgets vary. And when the budget goes down for a field, suddenly they hunker down and pull in the walls and they don't want to work with anybody. So it's very difficult. But it's a way to convene scientists to talk about this issue and see if there are some bright ideas in the group. My idea would be to take advantage of a development that has really occurred, namely a group of fundamentalist evangelical ministers has taken on the climate change issue. They've said, we're supposed to be stewards of the earth. We are literal interpretationists, literal believers in the biblical word, and we believe God gave us the earth and we're supposed to take care of it. This is a serious problem. We need to get at it. You only need one big thing like that, I think, to agree on, to pull some people in the room who may be very different in their views of other issues, and you could maybe get the dialogue started that might branch out, at least would give better understanding in a more peaceful environment about why people hold different views on other issues. But you have to start with something that's important, about which all of you agree is important, and figure out what can we all do to address it. That's my idea.
I greatly appreciate your participation, and let's thank our panel.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Nigel, it's wonderful to meet you.